This book, no Ordinary Moments. The title's on the board here for you. Write it down on your bibliography. It's not in the bib. And it's by Dan Hillman. It talks about the interaction with the sinners and what you can do in your free time, if you have any, especially you said, let's make some time, is to, if you have a chance, pick up the book and look through it. There's exercises in how to develop the other sinners. I'm going to talk a little bit about that today, also about communication styles. Now, yesterday we talked about threat and defense, the different defense mechanisms that come up in people to protect their self-identity. And to those of you who are new today, raise your hand if you haven't heard about the Enneagram before. Okay. Feel free to ask questions. If I use terms that you don't recognize, you're going, what is this zombie talking about?
I'm real fast.
Well, I won't tell you what I've heard then.
Everybody already knows a whole lot about me, right?
Okay. In just a nutshell, what we're doing is talking about the Enneagram. The Enneagram means, Ennea means nine, gram means point. And it looks like this. And like most of our lives, it's out of focus.
Oh my.
Okay. Do that. Okay. This is the symbol. And it looks a little strange, maybe. But the lines indicate paths. They're like roads, okay? Don't look at it as a symbol which has all kinds of occult and weird meaning to it. What it really means is that there are nine distinct personality patterns. And these end up being more like a hometown that you're from. So you may take on traits of a different type, but you're going to find that you fit in, that you feel most comfortable in one of these particular areas. And even though you may, for example, find yourself as an assistant and define yourself as being helpful. I am helpful to other people, I am helpful to my company, I'm helpful to whatever, but I want to meet someone else's needs. You may take on the wisdom of the five, take on that knowingness, but you're going to do that as somebody who really lives here. It's sort of like, I may live in Wallingford, but when I go to Ballard, I kind of compare it to Wallingford, and I'm using you as an example because it's not the husband today. The whole idea with the Enneagram is that every one of these types, all these characteristics are in you all the time. But especially under conditions of stress, you're going to experience your type most readily. Now this can be usually in relationship with somebody else. Because, oh my God, everybody's not like me. You'll find that when you're with people of like type, if you're an author and you're with a lot of other authors, there's this sense of community that develops almost immediately. There's really no way to explain it except that there are so many similarities in you that a lot of the differences can be overlooked. But the differences between the author 4 and the inspector 1 can be very great, and that can lead to communications difficulties. So that what you're transmitting as a message may not be what's received on the other end. So what I'm going to talk about today, and for those of you that are new, if you want to talk to me a little bit after class, if you have really confusing questions about what I mean by sinners, I'll be glad to meet with you for a few minutes afterwards. The interaction of the sinners is really critical when we're talking about communication. We talked about the heart center being very the emotional center. And I mentioned that in communicating, it's important to create an emotional connection between you and the person or group that you're communicating with. Without that emotional connection, without that electrical fire running between people, and you can usually tell it when you look in people's eyes. If you're talking to people and you're looking out the window, you don't know if they're listening or not. And they may not be listening because you're not looking at them. They don't feel part of what's happening. So one of the key issues when you're dealing with a person, another person especially, is to look at them. Be with them in the same moment. Now there are no ordinary moments. And you may think, oh, I've heard all this before, I don't want to talk about this. But every time somebody's talking with you, there's usually something that's being transmitted, and their words may not be what they're trying to tell you. And this is where it gets tricky. The different centers in each one of the types has a different need that they're trying to meet. Right. So why don't I quickly show you how each of the types communicates. And I'm going to tell you three or four things about them. How they communicate verbally, how they communicate non-verbally, and how they keep their personal space, which is also a way of communicating. Now, this isn't space, the final frontier. This is the space you have at home, which is sometimes vacuumed, and in the case of some sevens, probably sometimes not. Communication styles look like this. And I'll give you a minute to look it over and mull it over, and then I'll go into more detail.
When you say a number, could you mention the name of
it? I will. Okay, I'm sorry. I refer to the numbers and the names interchangeably. Real quickly, the number one is the inspector. The number two is the assistant. And while you're reading through this, I'll just mention this. The inspector one identifies themselves as hardworking. The assistant number two identifies themselves as I am helpful. That's how they live their life. I want to be helpful to other people. You'll find a lot of assistants in the nursing profession. Where else can you help other people and get paid for it? So number three, the administrator defines themselves as I am successful. Therefore, what I do must be successful because I identify with what I do. If the project fails, then I'm a failure. So the three's identity is I am successful. The number four, the author, identifies themselves as I am unique, I'm special. I am non-ordinary. In fact, being ordinary and common sets up a fear reaction in the four, and they try even harder not to be ordinary. The number five, the sage, identifies themselves as I am knowledgeable. I am knowing. I have this great accumulation of knowledge, and that's what they try to do, is learn as much as they can and analyze. And it's sometimes difficult for them to express their feelings. The three centers, real quick before I finish this, the three centers are the gut center, which is the eight, the nine, and the one, the champion, the negotiator, and the inspector. The heart center, which is the assistant, the administrator, and the author, and the head center, which is the sage, the facilitator, and the optimist. So these different centers interact with each other, and we have a preferential center, which is usually a little more developed, almost overdeveloped, compared to the other two, and it tends to take charge. So in case of the sage five, it's the head center that's a little more developed. The facilitator six defines themselves as I am loyal. I'm concerned about the group, my place in the group, what's happening out here. I get my authority from outside, and that makes me feel safe. The optimist seven, the last of the head center people, defines themselves as I am joyful, I am delightful, I am enthusiastic, I am ready to go. But mostly I am joyful. The champion, eight, defines themselves as I am powerful. I am powerful. And can be intimidating. It's making sure they know where the power is when they walk into a situation, and if they can, they have that power. They want to be the most powerful person in the room, because otherwise they have something they have to push against. And the champions define themselves by pushing against reality. The negotiator, number nine, defines themselves as I am okay. Everything's okay, okay? Peaceful, calm, no conflict. That's their threat, is being in conflict. They don't mind it. To go into the communication styles, try to think of examples of people you know, whether from movies or actuality, perhaps in your family, perhaps from school, wherever, that communicate like this. Now, what we've learned about the Enneagram is that each type has their own special need that they're trying to meet. And in communicating, we all have a bias. We all have a certain way we like to talk to people, because it helps us express who we are, and it's also the carrier wave, if you will, that our message is transmitted on. When you pick up your telephone and you hear that dial tone, what you're doing is getting a hold of an electronic signal that's going to carry your voice transmission to the person on the other end. So think of this as the carrier wave, and the message is what's going along on top of it. I'm going to start with the number 8, the champion. In the movies, Clint Eastwood is a very typical type 8. Eights don't necessarily have to say a lot to say a lot. And their favorite way of communicating is to come up to a power authority, somebody who's on a pedestal, proselytizing about how wonderful things are, or that they're in control, and very quietly debunk them. What makes you think you're so powerful? They cause doubt in the person that they're talking to, because it's a way an 8 has of gaining more power. So here's this person standing up 20 feet in the air, and the 8 comes over and sort of kicks the pedestal. And the whole thing starts to go like this, and the person on top becomes a little bit more intimidated. Here's somebody who could knock me off my pedestal. The champion tends to dress very comfortably. And what I'm going to tell you is, it's not so matter what people wear, but how they wear it. It's how they express themselves. And I'll give you an example in a few minutes of what I mean. In the Clint Eastwood movies, for example, Clint's never really a fashion hound. His clothes are comfortable. 8s don't like to feel bound, so they tend to wear more loose-fitting clothing. It may not always be color-coordinated, because what's important to the 8 is how they feel inside. And they want to be comfortable. They got to be able to move. They tend to be very physical people. Now, that doesn't say they won't wear track uniforms and the right ski clothing. I mean, they'll dress appropriately, but for the most part, they dress very comfortably. And you can see this 8's space sometimes can be almost Spartan. Everything tends to be very utilitarian. If it doesn't have use, I don't need it. It slows me down. If I don't need this in my space, it shouldn't be in my space. So it's not unusual to see what would like rustic furniture sitting in the 8 space. Now, not all 8s are going to have the same kind of furniture. It may be brand new, but you'll usually see very straight lines and very simple utilitarian furniture in your space. The 8, remember, is primarily gut center with a subdominant head or a secondary head center, which means first they do, then they think, then they feel. So comfort is important to them because they're in a gut center, and the gut center people like to be physically comfortable. And you may look around and say, well, I don't see anything that's, you know, pictures of family or some other things that other centers might consider more important. But there is probably a book that the 8 has somewhere on a shelf that has pictures of everybody they've ever known that's important to them. Because their heart center is something they keep very tight to themselves. And exposing that soft marshmallow inner side of them isn't something they readily do, but they do have it. And once they've given you access to that, once they've let you into their trust, then that 8 will come to your aid in the middle of the night. That champion will come to you in your darkest hour because they really believe in the people that they know and the people that they love because they don't have that many connections. So if you know any champions, remember when they're saying, so, what makes you think you're so great? They might be telling you that they love you. It can be a sarcasm, a cutting in. What they're really doing is pushing against you with language, much like they would push against you physically. The number 9, the negotiator, equalizes everything. When you're talking with a negotiator, remember that they're mostly gut. They're in the center of the gut center. And when they talk, they can sometimes sound like they're rambling. So that when you're done listening, you're not really sure what the most important thing they said was. They tell you 17 things, and you're going, well, nothing seems to have more weight than anything else. They can almost talk in a monotone. Now, this isn't something they do on purpose. They're not trying to bore you. But because nothing to them has any greater weight than anything else on the surface, because if it did, it would create conflict. I would have to choose and prioritize. Well, that creates conflict in some. So rather, I'll just let everything remain the same. Usually, the first thing that they say is the most important. When they finally talk to you, and you get their attention, and they're talking with you, the first thing that they say will be the thing that's most important. And think about that, and then when they get done with their monologue, go back and question them about that first thing. Then you're going to start communicating more efficiently. A good example of the nine from movies that I've seen would be Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. I'm going to keep everything calm. I want to keep everything okay. And this is more toward the beginning of the movie, where he gives up things that he wants to do in order to keep the family business going, to keep this happening. He's trying to ameliorate and pacify everyone so that everything stays the same. We don't want to let Mr. Potter take over the savings and loans, so we're going to keep this going. We're going to keep this going. And he basically sacrifices his own desires to travel around the world. He has this big suitcase, but he says, I'm going to stay here and do this. And then he ends up going to the dance, and he does all these things, but George Bailey keeps taking care of everything to make sure it's okay. Now, this is very different than, say, the two who would take care of one other person to make sure they were okay, or the six who's trying to take care of the community. He's just trying to keep the conflicts from happening. And then at the end, his colors really come out when he does take charge. And that's a movement, a healthy movement, when the nine actually starts to assert themselves. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. I'm trying to think of good examples. I've got some other things. I think you've all got the sheets of the movies. You have that? Here. If you turn to those, there are a lot of examples in here from different movies. And if you've seen the movies, it may make sense. What I'll do is pass these around. If you don't have them, take them. If I run out again, I'm going to be here. At least if you can see one. So
yeah, they are.
Okay. Let me have one of the gut centers. I don't even have one.
That's not the one that's
yesterday. Just I just need one. Handouts like snow in here. Okay. Okay, well, the idea, I put a lot of movies down. Now, some of you may have seen some of these, some not. And that's what's so difficult about using examples, is I'm not sure who's familiar with what. I use Gerald Ford as a good example of a nine, in the way that he smoothed everything over, and the way that he carried himself. Nines aren't necessarily quick people. They don't tend to run fast. They're not in a hurry. Sometimes that really infuriates some of the types that are. But when they're talking to you, they tend to take their time. And that's what can be a little nerve-wracking when they're really explaining themselves, is that you want to say, come on, get it out, come out with it. But their way of doing it is to just go. Keep on keeping on. I'm going to talk to you like this. I hope you don't mind if it's a little slow.
Do negotiators ordinarily get by on a contract?
They can.
Or when they're average and not.
That's another spectrum. We've talked about healthy and unhealthy. And by gosh, I got to apologize to you because there is so much information that I would like to share with you. But because of the time limitations, I have to leave a lot on the cutting room floor. So I'm trying to give you just the gist of all of this. And this is something I've been studying for years, and I can't possibly fit it all into one place. So if you think you've come away with it today and that you know everything that I've told you, I've really done you a disservice. And I've been talking to several of you outside the workshop, and I've had this feedback that it's what I want to give to you is what I can give to you, not all that I can give. So if you have questions and you need clarification, please ask, because I'm going to try and move through this so we can all go to lunch, too. Okay. But refer to the movie sheets. If you see something that says, oh, that sounds like what you're talking about, then refer to that. And I'll fill in as much as I can. Nines tend to dress and be very comfortable. Their houses and their space will have like overstuffed furniture. They want to be very comfortable. They tend to be very good cooks. These are personal qualities. They like things that are homey. Home is very important because that's their center. That's where they revolve around. They don't like to get too far from it usually. Now they can be very, they're very peaceful at heart. So traveling can create conflict because there's a lot of unknowns that have to be dealt with. And the nine is really attuned to dealing with what they understand and what's readily available. They're not always known for quick thinking, but they tend to be very meticulous. They tend to take a hold of a project and have more staying power than any one of the other types because they move methodically, they move very slowly. They're like the tortoise and the hare in the race, where the tortoise would be the nine. The tortoise wins the race because the rabbit's out fooling around and being in a hurry and full of pomposity. But the idea is it's a good example of how a nine moves through life. And you may think this person isn't accomplishing anything, and yet they're the ones that are getting the awards at the end because they've had the staying power to get the projects and things accomplished. And when they talk, they equalize. This is not more important than that. What they wear will tend to be things that make them kind of disappear into the background. They're not real comfortable standing out in front of people and being judged or being admired. It's better to stand in the background and observe, and then you can see them almost disappear, camouflage into the back. Sometimes. Well, number one, the inspector, when they're talking to you, they tend to moralize. You should be more like this. Why can't you be more like your sister? Why? Look at that boy down the street. He's such a good boy. Why can't you be more like that? I think that you should change your job and do something that's more important. They tend to moralize because there's this high sense of right and wrong for the inspectors. They tend to know what's best for them, and sometimes they'll even tell you what's best for you. Because they have an ideal, and they're very good at troubleshooting. They see big picture very quickly, and they immediately notice the imperfections. If you hold up a white handkerchief with a spot, it's the inspector. You hold it up and they'll say, what do you see? And the inspector says, I see a spot. When most everybody else would say, I see a white handkerchief. Okay, they look for the imperfection because that's their keenness. Their criticality and their discernment is so strong. So when they see imperfection in other people or in the world, and it's always here, they're never at a loss for material, they can moralize and say, well, if only that picture were 2 inches to the left, it would be perfect. If only that bell was half a step sharper, it would be more in tune. Okay. These are the kinds of things they can be aware of. They tend to dress very well. They dress perfectly. They accessorize well. The watch matches the cufflinks, which match the buttons. The shoes match the belt, which match the earrings. I mean, there's all of this interconnecting that's going on because they know that you have to look a certain way. Houses tend to be very neat. Everything has its place and it has to be in its place. And if it's not in its place, it's going to get in its place. Even if they come in your house, they'll sit there and they'll know something's wrong. And when you get up to go to the bathroom, sometimes they might get up and take care of it. They don't think there's anything wrong with this because they see it as helping you. They see it as straightening out the chaos by imposing a little bit more order. And chances are when you come back, you may not even notice that something's been changed. Because it could be something very small. Maybe the newspaper on the table. And then they'll feel better because they've straightened something out. You want to explain that?
What's the best way to communicate with them?
Directly. And remember that the biggest threat to the one is the anger that they feel. So if they do something and you correct them, they don't like being corrected. Because if you're correcting them, they've done something imperfect. So when you're talking with them, you give them suggestions instead of directives. And if you have any one children in your lives, these are the kids that stay up late doing their homework because I haven't got the Pyrenees Mountains done just so yet. and they're working with the paper mache, and they'll stay up and working on it. And if it's not perfect, you'll hear this big slam as they dump it on the floor because it's just not good enough. They tend to be very hard on themselves. In fact, they're harder on themselves than you could ever possibly be on them. So they need encouragement. And believe it or not, the one thing they need to do is stop programming playtime and just have enough white space, enough margin in their lives to be able to do the unexpected things that come up. The most important thing for the Inspector One is to learn how to be spontaneous. And that sounds like an oxymoron. How do you learn to be spontaneous? They are so in control that it's learning to relax. Learning to sit in a jacuzzi for an hour and not worry about the water being the right temperature.
But what?
The water being the right temperature. Or is there enough chlorine in here so I don't get sick? So when you talk with them, invite them to play. Approach a problem more like a game instead of like an issue. Because if you get on an issue, they'll get on one side and you'll be on the other. And they'll use that intensity. And pretty soon you're done.
Okay, I give up.
The Heart Center Assistant 2 advises. Because their identity is to be helpful. I am helpful. I want to help you. I want to help you meet your needs. I want to meet your needs for you. Don't you bother cleaning up the garbage. I'll do it. You go and have a time in front of the TV. And this is for men or women. It doesn't matter. There is no sexual preference for any one of these types. In our culture, we tend to push women into the Assistant 2 role, and we tend to push and expect men to fall into the warrior or the champion role of the number 8. That's just something that culturally we've done. And I don't think it's absolutely right, because there are a lot of women, and I know them, and there's going to be one here next week, who's a very, very good champion 8. And she'll get in your face. But she's not doing it to be mean. It's just, that's how they help. That's how they do things. The advice of the 2 can be, are you sure you don't need another glass of water? Are you sure I can't get you something? Well, here, have another serving. Okay. You're a little too thin. Why don't you fatten up a little bit? Now, this may sound like the 1 thinking things should be a certain way, but the assistant really wants to try and help you meet your needs, and they'll do that through advice. They tend to dress very warmly. And it may sound stereotyped, but in clothing, that can seem more like motherly. They're very caring people, and they dress in a way that lets you know that they care about you. Now, it's not always true, but sometimes the 2, on the other side of that coin, can be very seductive. Because if they feel that your need will be met by dressing that way, that's how they'll dress. So they'll dress very suggestively, because their need is to please you. And this is another fine line. Men do this as well as women. The open collar routine with the gold chain, or whatever it happens to be, so that they can find out if you have a need, be it sexual or hunger or whatever. They can be sometimes the wolf in sheep's clothing, because they'll dress the way they think you want them to dress. But then they have their own agenda. They have their own needs that they want to meet too. In their space at home, it tends to be very comfortable. A lot of personal, what I call knickknacks or memorabilia. And if you're coming over to their house, and they know you're coming, and you've given them something 5 years before, what?
So you get it out.
It'll be out prominently on the mantle, on the shelf, near the table where you're going to be talking. They want you to know that you're important to them. Okay. And this isn't a bad thing, it's just that's how they communicate. Right. And what they're trying to do is say, I care about you. I really do. What are some of the examples from the heart here? Dolly Parton in Steel Magnolias, or Liz Taylor in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. These are very, let me take care of you type of roles. Some people have said that Alan Alda in MASH exhibits some of the two characteristics. He's really concerned with how people are going, but his activity seems to suggest he's more of an optimist seven, where he's more idea, let's do these crazy things.
Yeah.
But some of his deep down motivation seems to be that, you know, he's a surgeon and he really cares about his people, but he doesn't want to get too close to them. But he's really meeting other people's needs all the time. And you have to watch the show to look at that discernment, because again, we're using characters instead of real people.
Those people sort of have secret agendas, you know, like, maybe the stereotype of Jewish mother type, you know.
Yes.
And then, but they've got this thing in the back of their mind about what you might be doing for them or what they want you to do.
Right. See, each type has their own self-identity. Two self-identities, I'm helpful. The need of the two is, I need approval. I need you to appreciate me. I need to be felt real. And the only way I can do that is if you tell me so. But the hard thing is they don't tell you they need it. So when you buy them flowers, they're overjoyed because somehow you've read their mind that they need them. Twos have a lot of expectations of other people because their needs, they don't speak their needs. But they'll do more for you. And the more they do, the more they expect in return. So if you forget a birthday, forget the two's birthday, it can be a dismal thing, and they won't tell you how hurt they are. But they'll let you know. They'll burn dinner for you. Because if you don't... Does this happen? Okay. or something won't be ready. I mean, it's what happens is if the assistant two doesn't get approval and appreciation, they'll settle for attention. Because it's the relationship that makes them real. And if you're not saying, oh, honey, I really love you, I'm glad you did, here's some flowers you didn't expect, then pretty soon they think that you don't care. And they'll say, fine, I'll get your attention. And that can be as simple as dropping something in the kitchen and starting to cry. So when you come out, they go, oh, it's okay, don't worry about it. I still love you, everything's fine. So rather than getting the positive appreciation from inside themselves that they're doing a good job, that they're really feeling good about themselves, it comes from the outside. And that's the trade-off. That they do so much for you, but they do want something in return. And not only, and the idea of just altruistic giving and not expecting something in return is where they start to get their power, by giving creatively and then saying there are no strings attached. But for the average two, who's not self-aware of their own need, of their own needs, it tends to be this give and take. The administrator three propagandizes. Now these are the people that some people associate with used car salesmen. These are the people who really say, I know exactly what you need. This is the best car on the market. Let me tell you why. Professor Harold Hill from the Sound of Music, or not Sound of Music, but the Music Man. His goal is to sell trombones to the people of River City, to sell band instruments. So he propagandizes. He tells them exactly everything that's going to happen. He builds this dream about what it could be. And then he gets out of town before they find out what really happened. If he can. So, three's identity is, I'm successful. And what they want to do is succeed. And they will help to convince and persuade you that what their goal is ought to be the same as yours. They'll find a need that you've got. And they'll say, let me tell you how to do it. I have this special oil here. This is the oil of snake. And I tell you, it'll work wonders. It'll change the color of your hair. It'll change your life. It'll turn you right around. Now, there's a man named Lee Iacocca who became very good at this. He turned an entire company around because he convinced and persuaded the entire country of the United States that Chrysler was a good automobile when it had been falling right down the tubes. The way they come across is very successful. Very successful clothing. It's not unusual to see them in a three-piece suit when they're coming in. Because it's professional, and it's that status, that quality, that lends them a certain shine. And not like the one. The one will dress because, well, put it this way, they dress more like a lawyer, and the three dresses more like an entertainer. Okay. Ones dress a certain way because that's the way they're going to meet their objective, their ideal is that they should look a certain way all the time.
Dress for success.
Well, the threes dress for success because that's part of it. And if they dress down, then they may not be as successful as if they didn't. Now, they dress comfortably, too. It depends on the situation. They may not be trying to make the big sale. They may just be trying to get into line in the movie first. They may just be doing almost anything. But threes tend to dress comfortably, but also to match the situation that they're in. They keep their space pretty casually. Their personal space at home tends to be much like they are. They have trophies out, things that remind them of their success. It's not unusual to see a lot of certificates. Best salesman of the year, best teacher of the year, best this, because the word best and win mean a lot to the three. And they'll talk a lot about things that they've done in the past where they've won. Well, when I was captain of the high school football team, I was just a member of the team, I was the captain of the team, and I threw that touchdown back in 1989, and they'll have the news clipping out on the wall, because it serves to reinforce their personality, that what they like is to succeed. I think it was probably a three that said, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. Mm-hmm. It's Newt Rockne, right?
Vince Lombardi.
Vince Lombardi, thank you.
One of those guys over and over again.
But there's that drive, there's that push of them. There's that push, and they'll get you to believe that. And that's, threes make great coaches, because they have a way of rallying a team. We're going to go for it. And these guys go running out onto the field and get almost pummeled to death. But chances are they've either won or they've come awful darn close. So it's this pep talk that you'll get from them. The author four laments. There is a certain, the identity is I am unique. Nobody's ever had the feelings that I have. Nobody's possibly felt as deeply as I do. Now, for example, if a author four walked in the room and was evaluating the room and the situation, it might be something like this. It's so wonderful to be here. And there's this internal rehearsal that seems to be going on where they can't quite find the word to express their feelings. And when they live with other feelings all of the time, they define themselves as being special, but they want a non-ordinary, which means that when they describe something, it has to be described in a way that's never been described before. To give the final word that should almost be framed and put someplace. Because it's reaching in such a depth and it's so exquisite to be pronounced. Fours dress very uniquely. They will tend to wear something that may look very plain, but you'll usually find a pair of $1,000 diamond-studded sandals if they're just supposed to be wearing a plain black gown. Or the special brooch from the 17th century to accent an otherwise plain outfit. Now, I want to use an example between the negotiator 9 and the author 4, and that at a social gathering, which is all black tie, long black formal gowns, both the 9 and the 4 would have the black gowns on, required dress. However, the 9 would tend to stand with people and be part of this group, blending in so as not to be seen, where the 4 might walk just a little bit more slowly, maybe have one eye on the mirror, or as they go by the coffee urn, maybe admiring themselves in reflection, just enough. And also watching the other people to make sure they're being seen. Now this isn't like the 3 who would strut in and demand the attention. The 4 would more walk in like a work of art and be admired. Okay. 4s like the admiration, because if they're being admired, then they're special. So the lamenting talk and the way that they communicate, they have so much emotion. They really wish you could read their minds, because then you would have experienced the depth of emotion. You wouldn't have to ask them how they feel, because aren't they showing you? Aren't I telling you everything you need to know with one look? Well, this really boggles the head-centered people. This boggles them. They go, what?
Yeah.
Give me some facts here. Give me some information. Talk to me, use words. Use your language. And the author says, well, I am. So the author force can be very misunderstood. And that's one of the things they need that would help them to communicate better would be to actually express more. To become more expressive. Now, this doesn't mean to be more dramatic. It just maybe means being a little bit more ordinary and talking like regular people talk. Let's see, a good example of a four. Did anybody here see Amadeus?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Does anybody remember F. Mary Abraham as Salieri? Mm-hmm. Who wanted to be the great court composer?
Oh, yes.
And he was so envious. He wasn't even jealous of Mozart. He was envious. Because here's this child, this obscenity, writing music from the angels. And Salieri composes, but oh my God, it sounds so ordinary. It's not filled with genius. He's an accomplished musician. He writes beautiful music. It's better than 95% of the people at the time could write, but he's not better than Mozart. He doesn't have that, and it makes him crazy envious, and he sets out to destroy his adversary. With a single-mindedness that just takes over the movie, and it's just astounding to watch.
So Salieri is the four?
Salieri is the four. And he enlists the emperor and everybody else to help him prove that Mozart's just an insignificant child. Yeah.
What is Mozart?
Mozart's a seven.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Partying, drinking, optimistic, enthusiastic, having a wonderful time until he does one thing. And that's when he writes his music. He focuses so intensely that he becomes a natural channel for this inspiration to come through. But as soon as he's done writing his music, it's party time. And he doesn't take a lot of responsibility. He died a pauper, which we'll talk about sevens in a few minutes, but money to a seven is something to be used immediately. They're not known for having large savings accounts. They're not known for having low limits on their credit cards. They tend to be extravagant because life is to be enjoyed, and in order to enjoy it, well, if I've got money in my pocket, I can go enjoy something. Okay. And the other types tend to be a little bit more thrifty, especially nines. Nines tend to have a lot because they accumulate. They don't put out too much. But the sevens have a hard time. They need to marry somebody rich who doesn't mind if they spend all their money. Anyway, that's just a joke. Not too fun either. Okay. Going over to the head center. We have our stage fives. Now, the fives are information people. They define themselves as, I am knowing, I'm knowledgeable. I have all this information, and I'm going to have more. They're like gold miners. They go up and they find a vein of knowledge, and they mine it. And they mine everything they can out of it. They put it in their backpack, and then they keep going further into the mountain to find more. Do they spend a lot on books, on more knowledge? Sure. But do they spend their knowledge? Well, that's a difficult thing. What the five likes to do to communicate is explicate. Now, this is different from explaining. If you ask me a question, and I explain it to you, I don't have to give you everything. But if you ask the five a question, then and they know, they're not to give you a treatise. They might even explain it to you with 10 or 11 analogies to make sure you got it.
Yes. Say the same thing in three different ways, or more.
Right. And the reason is that because they feel they know so much, obviously no one else could know more. So if you're not as smart as me, you must be stupid. And if you're stupid, I have to explain it to you till you understand it. And the best way to diffuse that when you're communicating with a five is to nod and go, I understand. Before they get into the second or third analogy. And they're not trying to be condescending. Because inside they're not thinking, oh, this person's a fool. It's just that they're like relieved that they get to explain something that they know. And it's even worse than trying to explain something that they don't know. Because then they try to explain it to themselves out loud. Fives tend to be, like I said, they're observers, so they tend to stay back and watch what's happening. And they pull it all in, and usually at a meeting, they're the last ones to voice an opinion. Somebody has to go to them and say, well, what do you think? Now, if you ask a five what they feel, they get very confused. Because feelings aren't something they're used to thinking about. They're used to empirical data, numbers, facts, equations. Reading the encyclopedia is a good thing. If you're a five, there's lots more to know. So if you ask them what they think, they'll tell you, well, I think da-da-da-da-da-da-da. There aren't any questions, are there? Because they've given you a definitive answer. And that's how they talk to you, with this sense of finality. I have told you what it is. Why would you have any questions? If you have any questions, then you can't be very smart, because I've already given you the answer. Okay, I'll give it to you again. Here, let me explain it this way. You still don't get it. Until finally, you want to just sock them. Yeah, Tom.
Doesn't the five explicate as a means of discharging an obligation? This is my burden.
That's right. Here's the baton.
We all have things to do, and now it comes my turn, and I'm going to explain this to you, because you shoveled the walk, and you made dinner, and I explained.
That's right. This is my job. This is
a caller.
That's right. And remember that the gift of each of the types is important. Everybody's doing their best to do what they can. But sometimes we drive each other crazy. Because what you want and what you expect me to give you isn't what I'm capable of providing. And I'm not aware that you need that information in this particular way. They tend to dress very comfortably. I think the character of Judd Hirsch in the movie Ordinary People, he plays a psychologist, even in the show Taxi, very, almost frumpy. They're almost like the absent-minded professor who, you know, have on the old ragged sweater, and they're comfortable. And the pipe and the cup of coffee, there's these accessories that they have that sort of make you remind you of a professor. And professing is what they do. I have this knowledge, I must give it away. And once they have enough confidence to teach others, they're sort of, I don't know what it is, but they develop this posture. I guess it's the best way to say it. There's this, I had a teacher in college who taught history, and he was a Catholic priest that was about 180 years old. And he had what we call the theory of Devonian motion. His name was Father Don. And every time he spoke, his hand would do this. He was like he was turning pages in his mind as he talked to us. And it was the most droning, boring, terrible speaking I'd ever heard. Learned a lot of history. The guy had nothing but facts in his head, but I didn't get the feeling that he cared about what he talked about. He was not an energetic speaker. He didn't get your attention. You were there because you had to be there. And I got the feeling he was there because he felt he had to be there. But the professant, the pouring forth of information, was endless. A good example of the five would be Yoda in Star Wars again. He's the wise little elf that lives on another planet all by himself. And when he speaks, he's learned, I'll just give you a little bit. This is all you need. And then you're supposed to figure it out. Sometimes speaking in puzzles. Robin Williams in the movie Awakenings is a very good example of somebody he's been studying earthworms and reproduction of earthworms for years. Isn't this exciting? Well, now he's got to deal with people who are stuck in a sleeping sickness. So he comes out of that and starts becoming more of a leader and sharing his body of knowledge.
So, furnishings would be more like a study or furnishings?
Furnishings, their den is their favorite spot. There's usually books all over the place. It's, and things of value, archaeological paintings and things that have not importance to knowledge. Libraries are wonderful places. New bookstore in town, I'm on my way. Gotta check it out. Gotta find out where everything is. So that's another resource center. The number six, cautions. Remember that they're interested in how the group is doing. So when they talk to you, it's almost like, well, have you thought about how this might affect XYZ? Don't you think we really ought to talk to the talk to your parents before we decide to do this? Mm-hmm. Shouldn't we talk to somebody else and get another opinion? You know, you really shouldn't speed down the freeway. What if there's a highway patrolman on? Be careful up on that ladder, you're going to fall. I mean, there's this constant worry that something's going to happen that they can't handle. And it's going to affect the whole group. I mean, if you're up on the ladder and you fall off, then they're going to have to take care of you, or somebody's going to have to take care of you, or maybe there won't be any income in the house, or who knows what's going to happen. And you say, I'm fine, I'm on a ladder. But there's this sense of worry, and that's why a lot of people put the sixes in the category of being paranoid, because they seem to be overly cautious. And they're very big picture people. They look so at so much that it's like if anything changes that picture, it could be disastrous. They're like a little seismograph. What's going on? The example of Luke Skywalker is what I've used in the last few days for the six. Holly Hunter in broadcast news, always nervous, always worried about what's going to happen next. C-3PO in Star Wars is a really awful example. But he works as a six. He's always on the alert. Well, I don't know how to do this. It's scary. Oh, Master Luke. Oh, this. Oh, no. You just want to just knock him down. I was really glad when they took him apart. Oh, good. For a while. But he's also very good at managing to get people together and make things come together. I mean, he's the one who actually saves the day at the end. He keeps them from getting killed because he manages to be able to talk this really awful, weird language to the computer so it understands. And saves the day. But he's really there because he knows if he doesn't save the day, that he'll die. So it's his membership in the group that matters to him. And move over to the optimist seven. Sevens communicate by entertaining. Sometimes they'll tell you a story, and they get to the end of the story, and you wonder what exactly it has to do with anything. But while they're telling it, it's fascinating. They are good at holding attention. And because life is a big joyride to them, it's easy for them to become very enthusiastic about what they're saying. And they have ideas all the time, and they love to share those ideas with you. And it usually can make people tired, because the more they talk about their ideas, the more ideas they get, the more ideas they tell you, the more ideas they get, the more ideas they tell you. Until finally, you just want to take a cork and go, whoop, put it in there. Because that's how they like to talk. I didn't talk about the sixes space. Sixes, I would say, have fairly conventional space. For the most part, things are organized and balanced in their space. The books are here, the dresser is here, or the cabinet or buffet with the silverware in this drawer, and most people keep their silverware in the kitchen in this drawer, so that's where I'll keep mine. The cups are hung neatly. Everything is functional, because remember, they're concerned about when you walk in, they want you to feel okay. A good example of I think a six company would be the Motel 6 chain. It's always the same wherever you go. There are no surprises. And that's what six is really like. I don't like surprises. Because if it's a surprise, I've got to do something new. I've got to figure out a new way to deal with it. But if it's the same, then it's fine. Holiday Inn, Motel 6. And I don't care what hotel I go to, there's usually two queen-size beds, a little table, a really ugly painting and a big mirror for the dresser. And the bathroom's back this way, and they've always got that little strip wrapped around the toilet. it's like some kind of cult. Home again. I'm at home. Exactly. I'm home. Oh, this is just great. It's the same.
How do sixes dress, Jim?
Sixes dress the way you dress. Sixes, if everybody else in the room is wearing shorts and the six is wearing pants, they'll go home and change. They don't want to be different. Sixes are really good, they like to wear uniforms. Okay. Military, I think, is a whole six organization. That's not bad, it's just the way they are. And because of that, that's where they get their power. Sixes get their power from being part of a group. I talked yesterday a little bit about the Nazi movement in Germany. The whole thing was set up about being six. If you're part of the group, you have the power. If you're not part of the group, powerless. So join us and be powerful. And it was infected the young people. Nazi that were just, they may not have been sixes. And that's not saying everybody who was a Nazi was a six, don't get me wrong. There were some real eights in that movement too. And some ones and some fives. And there wasn't a lot of heart in that. It was all gut, head, and, we're going to roll over and take over the world. Heart people aren't interested in taking over the world for the most part.
So what was Hess?
I don't know. Hitler seemed to be a very big six because he surrounded himself with people all the time. So he'd be safe. Safety is a real critical issue, but it's safety within the group. But even team sports. Like I said yesterday, I coach soccer, and I get these kids, and they're kind of, at practice, they're all over the place because they don't have the uniforms on, but somehow you put the uniform on them, and they're all part of the team, and they cooperate. Mm-hmm. It's cooperation that Sixers are really interested in. I want everybody to get along with everybody else. And if there's somebody that's not getting along, then I'm going to find an eight to make you get along.
Japanese are Sixers.
Yeah. Oh, very much so. The Japanese culture is very six. Everybody. Yeah, go ahead.
Very homogenous.
Very homogenous. And if you're different, you're an outsider. And if you're not Japanese, then don't
bother.
You
can never even try to be Japanese.
Yeah, and if you're not born in Japan, I mean, it's a very six-ish group. The way that they transmit information, put it on.
Does the word tribal fit?
Yeah, I think in the history of our species, the tribes would develop a sense of continuity within the group. In fact, what we were talking about today with this Bible study regarding the Philistines and the Israelites and all of these things that were happening, there's this, our group is better than your group. And that's I think, where a lot of our, well, even racial problems come from. If you're not white, if you're not of color, if you're not Asian, if you're not part of our group, then you don't belong. And that's a prejudice that we're all trying to overcome personally and culturally. And it's been with us forever. So that's something we need to keep working on. Moving over to the seven, though, I talked about Julie Andrews and Sound of Music and her ability to make play clothes out of drapes and to face all situations with this entertaining ability. And she's always singing. Whenever there's a problem, and sevens are known to just go into song. That reminds me of a song, and they'll sing it for you. They tend to dress very colorfully. I'm a seven, by the way, if you didn't guess. And at least that's where I found most of myself. And their spaces are usually full of all kinds of toys, interesting things to play with, knickknacks that say, oh, I remember when I was in Glacier Park, and oh, I'll tell you all about it. And they'll sit down and tell you a story about this stone that they found. There's a lot of movies with sevens. We talked about Tom Pulci doing Mozart in Amadeus. I think Michael Keaton does a lot of seven-type roles. Though when he played Batman, and the whole interesting thing about the Batman mystique is that he was a five. And that in order to come out of his shell, he had to put on a costume and be somebody else in order to make a difference in society. Here he's this rich, wealthy Bruce Wayne millionaire. But he's an entire recluse. Howard Hughes was a five. Very, very tight, very protective. And it's that coming out that really makes the five come alive. Sevens do that. Dennis Quaid in The Big Easy. And an interesting one, if any of you saw The Doctor with William Hurt, I don't know if any of you saw that. He's a seven. But there's something that happens. In his operating room, he's got on this rock and roll music, and he's playing, and he's going crazy, and they've got the organs out, and they're going like this at each other.